Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about two movies in the theater now, Respect and The Suicide Squad. And we're going to start with Respect, which is the Aretha Franklin biopic with Jennifer Hudson, who was handpicked by Aretha Franklin to play this role. I don't even know where to start, Mike, because I absolutely loved everything about this film. I loved Jennifer Hudson as Aretha Franklin. I loved the, I thought, very nuanced portrait of her father, played by Forest Whitaker. The music, of course, is incredible. And the costumes, the furs, the jewelry, the hats, Aretha's embroidered white dress. I mean, I hardly know where to start other than to start off by telling everybody to drop everything you're doing and go see this movie. Where do you stand, Mike?
Well, Marie, you know, I absolutely idolize Aretha Franklin. I actually met Aretha Franklin twice over the years, and I was in such awe of her. And I've got to say, she managed to be both regal and gracious, you know, but she was such a, even among divas, like a super diva. And so, and I've seen her in concert, gosh, probably, you know, half dozen times that I saw her live in concert as well. And she's one of my all-time favorite performers. So, and by way of enthusiasm, by way of level of interest, it matches yours, Marie, in the sense of I was just mesmerized by the film. By way of response to the film, I was a bit more measured. You know, I was always, you know, wide-eyed and just totally taking it in, and the music is fabulous. But here are a few of the reasons why my response was more measured. Even though Jennifer Hudson was handpicked by Aretha Franklin, and that counts for a lot because she could be very particular about saying yes to things, more often said no to things. Jennifer Hudson does not have a very strong physical resemblance. It's persuasive enough. And likewise, vocally, Jennifer Hudson obviously has got really strong technique. I mean, she doesn't need anyone to, you know, to say otherwise. I mean, she's really, you know, obviously a top-notch vocalist. However, her voice doesn't have the heft, doesn't have the fullness. That's the word I like to use, that Aretha Franklin's voice was more full-bodied. And other critics of this film, I don't mean in the sense of being critical, negative, but just observational, they've pointed out that Jennifer Hudson's singing, when she does one of Aretha's numbers, it's completely convincing, it's persuasive. And yet, Aretha Franklin had that fuller bodied voice, and it's the emotion that comes through. With Jennifer Hudson, I more often was aware of the technique, admirable technique, and emotionally affecting, sure, but not the way Aretha Franklin could sing something and just totally knock you out. You feel like this really was soul singing. This is from the soul. And not to say Jennifer Hudson doesn't have a soul, but maybe she doesn't have quite as much soul as Aretha did. So by way of the actual performance, that was a reservation for me. Again, didn't knock the film down, you know, too many notches, but it did. It was something I noticed. Let's put it that way. One of the main reservations I have has to, I have no qualms with the film having a running time of 145 minutes. I could spend hours and hours watching anything about Aretha Franklin, right? So I that wasn't a problem. But you know what? In the scripting, it's more or less a standard biopic. It has some real boilerplate dialogue, and on a humanistic level, on a thematic level, it needs to be there. I agree with it. But sometimes it's a little too much like on the nose, if you will. Just like, you know, here's a scene where we're going to say something significant about the civil rights movement. And you get those two or three sentences where, bam, we hit it. And I'm thinking, yeah, you hit it. But, you know, but where it just seems like it's sort of like not quite paint by numbers, but you get a sense of, you know, they're hitting certain points. Of all my reservations about the film, the one that actually I would say is the most significant for me as a viewer is I think the film spends too much time with her very early life. Now, there's a very gifted child actor who plays her as a child. So, you know, those scenes can be quite mesmerizing. And in terms of the family dynamic, and Forest Whitaker is terrific as her father. So all due credit there. But there are many, many scenes in like the first half hour of the film that's essentially, you know, Aretha as a little girl. Thematically, biographically, certain points are expressed that need to be expressed. So absolutely, they should be there. But then you'll get like a second or third scene doing sort of the same thing, right? Just kind of reiterating that. And then what happens is, and on a technical level, this is impressive. On a thematic level, more problematic. The film, I think, tends to smooth some of the rough edges in her life. She had a really difficult personal life. I'm trying to think how to diplomatically phrase it. She was not an easy person in terms of her romantic relationships, in terms of raising a family, just, you know, a personal life. And it was, you know, documented. She tended to be very reticent in talking about that, like in interviews or, you know, articles about, you know, you're not going to get too much from her about that necessarily, but enough was known, enough that it was not an easy life in a lot of ways. So here's the point. We've been watching Aretha as a girl singing in her father's church, and her father was nationally prominent, you know, in ministerial circles and in the civil rights movement and just in the entertainment hierarchy, if you will. So, you know, people like Ella Fitzgerald and, you know, Louis Armstrong, you know, all those people are like, you know, that's who's in the living room, right? Those are the people hanging out, if you will. But anyway, the scene I was starting to reference is the young Aretha is singing in church, and there amounts to what I call a pan edit. By that, I mean that there's a pan, and it's very impressive technically. You know, the camera's panning and across the girl and the congregation, whatever else. And then, you know, sort of like the other side of the pan, you have Aretha as an 18-year-old woman, you know, singing in church. It gets her from childhood to young adulthood. It's really quite beautiful, actually, just as camera work and kicking it ahead. But here's the problem thematically. We spent, I didn't time, you know, I'm saying half hour, however long those childhood scenes are. For my taste, just it goes on too long there, because then what happens is on the other side of that pan edit, not only is she like 18 and now she's heading into an adult career, but we learn what I already knew, but the audience needs to learn is that she's a teen mother at that point. She was in her mid-teens, really early to mid-teens when she started having children. You know what? That is so finessed. It's so smoothed over. It's barely referenced in the film. If you know about her from other biographical sources, yeah, you'll know a little bit more about that. But in terms of getting inside her head, in terms of what it was like to be not just a teen mother, but at such an early age, the film just glosses over that. And then like for the rest of the film, you occasionally see her children, but they're not really worked into it in a very meaningful way. Like, what was she like as a mother? The extent to which I never actually met her children, but I did see them on stage in some of her later concerts. She would have her, by then, adult children as part of the ensemble on stage with mixed results, but I don't want to get sidetracked with that. But you know, and I would always wonder about that. You know, what's it like to be the child of Aretha Franklin? And then she's pulling out on stage to sing a number or play an instrument or something. But Marie, let me throw this back to you, because that was the film never lost me, but that was the scene where I thought, this is going to smooth over some really rough material. And even though the film does mention some of the low points, if you will, or more sensitive points in her life and career, I oftentimes felt like it had that inspirational sense of, you know, and she'll transcend this, she'll get through this, get over it, and so on. I say, well, yes, but maybe yes and no.
You know, you bring up it's a really good point, because I thought the same thing, that they did gloss over what was clearly an assault on an underage girl by some adult who was never held accountable. They do gloss over that. But I also felt like they sort of made it that way because it just shows this sort of slow beat down of her early years, where even something as devastating as that had to somehow be swept under the rug and overcome. And I was struck by watching it, because they downplayed it, that it was both devastating and you knew it, and yet downplayed in the same way I've heard similar stories of what happened growing up to Maya Angelou and even Oprah Winfrey, where yes, these horrible things happened and, you know, either your family talked about it or they didn't talk about it, but at some point you were supposed to just sort of overcome it and go on, and all the women I just mentioned do. And, you know, as we've talked about with many subjects, whether it's just general talking about film or something very specific about trying to encapsulate somebody's movie in a documentary, I mean, how long do we want to sit there and watch the movie? You know, if you include every salient point, you know, through its conclusion, you know, you're just going to be sitting there for days watching the story. In terms of Jennifer Hudson, I mean, Aretha Franklin was a once in a lifetime talent. And where are you going to find some mortal woman to play her? So I'm not going to take anything away from Jennifer Hudson, because yes, she doesn't look like Aretha Franklin, but she at least brings the powerhouse of her voice as, you know, the only person who could possibly have done the role, while recognizing that nobody could do that role except for Aretha Franklin. She just had that incredible timbre to her voice that nobody could replicate. So it's almost unfair to expect that. What I will say is that, yes, again, I went into the movie with some trepidation because it was going to go over 2 hours. But I will say that the theater was packed and nobody moved at the end, even though we'd sat there for over 2 hours. Everybody wanted to see it until that last credit. And it's one of those movies that I saw when opening weekend, where at the end, everybody clapped. So, you know, the emotional roller coaster they put you on, it is manipulative. You're right, Mike. They are deliberately doing things to, you know, get you to feel for the characters, but I think it actually works. Also want to call out Audra McDonald, who plays her mother in the film, because, you know, if you're stuck in your house, not willing to go out and see movies, you have probably seen her, or you should, as Liz Reddick on The Good Fight, which is on Paramount TV. And you can stream that from Amazon. Absolutely fantastic TV series. And Audra McDonald is wonderful in it.
Yeah, Audra McDonald is very, very good in the film. I mean, the supporting cast is so strong in this film. They really helped to carry it. In terms of salient points, again, if they had been tighter with that opening childhood section, they would have easily had like another 20 or 30 minutes to pick up on some of those aspects of her life that are just referred to in passing. But Marie, the thing you said that I really emotionally identify with so strongly at the moment is I also saw the film in a theater that was fairly crowded, and people were really pulled into it, and they stayed through the end credits and so on, and there was some applause. And gosh, you can't say that about too many films, right? And I was emotionally, you know, quite taken by it. So when I mentioned like what I call intellectual reservations on an emotional level, even when I would have an intellectual reservation, emotionally, the film was still hitting me. Like even in some of those early childhood scenes where I thought, well, do we need this scene or that one? You know what? On their own terms, those scenes work extremely well. So, you know, there's good manipulation and bad manipulation. And on balance, I thought this is like good manipulation in the sense of, you know, entirely justified and so on. And Marie, the other point you made that I quickly want to reiterate is that it is unfair to expect any actor to play, you know, the real life Aretha Franklin. Who could do it? Who would have a close enough physical and vocal resemblance? So, you know, it sounds like carping to say, well, she's not quite this, not quite that. I can't help but carp because that's my nature. But, you know, in all honesty, it's almost like an impossible assignment. And I think Jennifer Hudson probably gets about as close to playing that role as anyone could. And so that's why, even though like I could make observations that she's not quite this or that, it was persuasive watching it. And there aren't that many actors who would be persuasive in that role, right?
Now, a couple of things I thought were really fun about watching the movie. One is the whole behind the scenes look you get of, well, what happens when you go to the recording studio? I like that they included those scenes because I thought those were fun to watch. Obviously, all the music is amazing. So, you know, just sitting there listening to the music makes for an incredible movie. What did surprise me was how wealthy her family was. I had thought, you know, growing up as a pastor's kid, no matter how successful the church, I wouldn't have expected them to have been so influential, to have so much money to buy lovely clothes and furs and hats and gloves, and to know people like Dr. Martin Luther King. What about you, Mike? Did that surprise you? The opulence. This is not a rags to riches story.
I got to say, Marie, I was not surprised whatsoever because C.L. Franklin, he had the biggest church in Detroit. He had a national reputation, as I said earlier, not just in ministerial circles, but in the civil rights movement, in the entertainment world. He was a member of the elite, if you will. I mean, he really did well and prospered. And so it's not rags to riches at all. You know, she grows up really kind of pampered, really, really, you know, a family that's blessed, not just spiritually, but financially. And so, no, that was, and I thought the film captured that really well, that ambiance. And yeah, and then you do get, you know, Martin Luther King is you know, like Uncle Martin, you know, who you have in the living room. And that, those are fascinating scenes. So that's why in terms of like, you know, where would I cut back in the opening section? Yeah, there'd be some tough calls there for sure. The other thing you say, Marie, that I really identify with strongly, one reason why I watched so closely, because hers is a career that I did track pretty closely in terms of studio time. That she, you know, when she was working with John Hammond initially, a, you know, influential music producer, really famous. And this guy was no slouch. I mean, he's legendary because he really helped create the careers or further the careers of everyone from Billie Holiday to Bob Dylan. I mean, consider that. You know, John Hammond was a genius in a lot of ways, but he kind of missed an essential point with Aretha Franklin. She was signed by Columbia Records. And so in the very late 50s and through the mid 60s, she did I think it was nine or so, she did a number of albums for Columbia. She, you know, was recording and had a bit of a following, never really broke through to like big time stardom, but he had her singing like more conventional jazz standards and, you know, kind of like schmaltzy string arrangements and all. And some of those are quite good on their own terms, but not the Aretha. It's like being bottled up. Like you want to express your soul, but he's telling you to do something that's meant to be popular in the sense of it could, you know, play well to a middle brow audience or something. And somehow John Hammond didn't quite get it that way. And it was frustrating for Aretha because at that point she had a kind of shy personality and she's been controlled by, you know, and the men in her life, including managers and this and that. And she wasn't quite breaking through. Like what you want to do is just let her sit down at the piano and play and sing and just, you know, full-throated, you know, gospel into soul singing. And one of the pivotal scenes in the film to make that point is there's Dinah Washington, who certainly was blunt in her speech and, you know, giving her opinions, played by Mary J. Blige, a very good performance, actually. In the film, she has a dressing room encounter with Aretha, because Aretha on stage back in her Columbia days saw the Dinah Washington in the audience and thought, well, let me sing one of her famous songs as a tribute to her. That didn't go over well with Dinah Washington. It's like, that's my song, that's not your song. So it's an explosive dressing room encounter on the part of Dinah Washington, and that was very true to her character. You know, and then on a more tender note, pointing out to Aretha, don't sing my songs, sing your songs. You need some songs that are you, not songs that are me. Now, where the film plays a little fast and loose, it's a little bit of creative license here. In real life, that was a scene between Dinah Washington and the great Etta James. In the film, they strike Etta James. She gets mentioned in the film, but they strike her in that scene, and it's Aretha who's at the receiving end of Dinah Washington's wrath. And you don't want to be at the receiving end of her wrath, believe me. And so, you know, watching the scene, I thought, that's justifiable. I mean, it didn't bother me that you could say, well, that was really Etta James. So what? Thematically, it works there. Emotionally, it's true, if you will. But anyway, John Hammond didn't quite realize the full potential Aretha had. What made her a big, big star at the level of behind the scenes, and the film is really good at this, is Jerry Wexler, a music producer. And when she goes, you know, when she leaves Columbia and goes to Atlantic, where Jerry Wexler was a producer, and then does some recording in Muscle Shoals in New York and so on, that's where you get songs like Respect. That's where you get all the famous songs hitting. And Wexler knew what he had. He knew that, you know, get rid of the schmaltzy strings, just got a good R&B band in here, get some funky sounds, get that backbeat, and let her voice rise and rise, let the voice hit there. And at that point, and the reason I'm so in awe of Aretha Franklin, as I mentioned at the outset, is one of my music critic friends, professional music critic friends, he's made this point. He says, there is no other performer in American musical history who's had the great run, he used the word run, the great run she had from 1967 through the mid-1970s. Every album, every concert, everything, she just exploded on the scene. And when you think about the long arc of a career, I mean, she has some notable work in the years after that, but that period from 67 into the mid 70s is truly amazing. And I usually stop short of hyperbole, but it's the most amazing run in American musical theater history. And you can think of other great performers who've had like a good year or a good decade, but nobody or very few people could match what she did in those years. But it was Jerry Wexler who really let her cut loose that way. And then she fully arrived. And, you know, when she's been described as having the greatest voice of the 20th century. And again, usually I try to back off from hype, but I'm not going to argue with that.
I'm not going to argue with that either. And I'm glad you used the word amazing, because one thing I also thought was genius about the movie was how it ends with the documentary that they made about making the album Amazing Grace, which turned out to be her biggest hit. But before we move on to our second movie, I just wanted to mention that I thought the theme was, you just get out of her way, because you know, she had a gift that was undeniable. I just want to get your quick reaction to whether watching it made you think at all about Ma Rainey's Black Bottom in terms of the character taking charge of her own career, no matter what people thought or had to say.
Well, I love Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I mean, I've seen the play a number of times, and of course the film version of it, and revere August Wilson. But in terms of personality type, Ma Rainey was always forthright, always outspoken, always bossing people around. I mean, she had that blustery personality. Aretha's personality was quite different in the sense that in her early life, you see that her father is rather severe with her and very controlling. And there are other men in her life, managers and romantic partners, who can be controlling, right? Her one husband slash manager, how controlling they could be. It takes her a long time to find her voice in various ways. And so she's a very different personality than Ma Rainey. But Marie, where you're correct, I think absolutely, is once she finds her voice, no one's gonna stop her at that point. And as I mentioned earlier, Marie, you know, that she in her mature career was very decisive. you know, in terms of yes or no to something, and very outspoken as to what she would do and not do. But that wasn't the young Aretha. And see, that's part of the awakening process for her, which did take a long time. And just, you know, discovering the talent she always had, it was always there. It was kind of bottled up in some ways. Rather than schmaltzy jazz arrangements, you know, you have gospel, which you have been singing. Why not have gospel kind of merge with, infuse with, you know, R&B and soul and just express it? And then you do get Amazing Grace in 1972. Not only is it the best-selling album of her career, but it's the best-selling gospel record ever. And then just, you know, a few years ago, speaking of documentary films, this is what Marie's referring to, there was that documentary film, which for various technical reasons was not released at the time in the early 70s, and only more recently finally got pulled together in the lab. And it's an overwhelming film. I mean, she's at her creative peak in a film like that, and you really fully understand. And so, Marie, I very much appreciate your point that in the film we're talking about, Respect, as it moves into the home stretch, the fact that, you know, it spends a lot of time actually talking about, you know, the shooting of that documentary about Amazing Grace. And it would be really wonderful, actually, just to watch these films. I mean, I've seen, you know, the other film, but to literally watch them back to back, because there's so much thematic overlap there. You could almost take a scene from one film and just plunk it in the other and we wouldn't be the wiser.
You could do a double header and it would go together really well. So I would say this is a movie to see in the theater, if only for the music. And I anticipate that there will be a lot of nominations when it comes time for the Academy to look at this, if nothing else for the costumes, because absolutely incredible. So now we're going to move to The Suicide Squad, which I don't think is going to be eligible for any Oscar nominations, Mike. I recommend nobody see this in the theater, to wait till it comes out, you know, on DVD, if that. But, you know, I have to also say it really didn't matter to me whether this movie was any good, because I will watch anything with Idris Elba in it. And I also like Margot Robbie. It did have a few moments of wit in the screenplay, but mostly I thought it was an action fest, the D-list of fringe villains. What about you, Mike?
I really actively disliked this film. Marie and I were talking before our show started, just, you know, back and forth, that we would sort of give it a vote for, like, you know, the worst movie of the summer kind of thing. And it really is kind of, now I want to get on a soapbox at this point. I would not actually get on one, or my head would be somewhere up here, not quite on your screen. But the soapbox I want to get on is this. This film has an R rating and richly deserves it. There had been, ironically, not that I'm asking for these movies, but there in 2016, there had been Suicide Squad, which was a lousy film, but, you know, not that it has anything to its credit, but it was rated PG-13. Because when you think about the sort of superhero storyline and characters and the audience for such a film, you would want, you know, to have kids and teenagers, you know, have free access, you know, authorized access, let's put it that way, to watch this film. So anyway, that one came out just a few years ago, right? And now here we have, you know, The Suicide Squad with an R rating. There is a lot of, I'm going to sound really puritanical here, and I don't think of myself as a Puritan, but, you know, there's a lot of really raw language in this, to the point where, like, do you have to use, like, you know, those vulgar terms, like, in every sentence sort of thing, just throwing them out there. And there's also a lot of really graphic violence. I mean, like, as in, like, you know, people being beheaded and stuff like that, and just blowing up on screen and stuff. Played for laughs, of course, and I'm not sure that's the most exemplary comment about American society, you know, in terms of what's done on screen, how we're meant to watch it. But I just thought the film was really kind of vulgar that way. In addition to being, like, vapid, but, like, being empty of content, the fact that it really is, like, almost risible. It's just, I found it almost offensive. And the fact that it's, and I'm talking now on a very pragmatic marketing level, you know, people eventually have access to films however they want, whether they should watch them or not. But it seems to me, certainly in terms of theatrical release, an R rating, I don't think is really appropriate for this particular kind of film. I think you want to get, you know, a PG-13 audience for it. But it's playing more to the hardcore action crowd that way. And it's kind of shameless the way it does that. The storyline is just so many, I call it like pop cultural references tossed in a blender. It's got so many of those things just thrown in there. And sometimes I'll laugh just because, oh, you know, there's a name I recognize, or that's a movie I've seen. But you know what? That wears thin after a while. And really, for a film that, you know, runs, again, over 2 hours, it's kind of wearing that way. And the film creatively, if I can even use the word creative with this film, it's just spinning wheels. I mean, there's really not a whole lot going on the story level.
Well, I'm giving you points for using risible in a sentence and just sort of tossing that off, but you're absolutely onto something there. Now, you know, it's not like there's not an audience that wants to hear from, you know, the the unsung people behind the scenes, or, you know, the people with a storyline who maybe are more of the darker, or the villains, whatever. I mean, let's look how much money Joker made, for example. You know, there is a desire to see the other side of the story. This just doesn't seem to give you much to hold on to in terms of likable characters, in spite of the, you know, really good and likable actors who are in it. It just somehow does not come off. This is not La Femme Nikita, where you want to know the story behind the person who went rogue, or, you know, went to the dark side. It's not the backstory of Darth Vader. It's none of that. It's just an excuse to have, you know, the villains have their day, but they're not even like the top notch. It's not even the Joker. It's like the, like I said, the D-list actors. So that's why I think it sort of fell down in terms of, like, honestly, do we need a third movie? Because, you know, there was Suicide Squad and there was Birds of Prey. I don't really think there was all that much unanswered questions. I will say I did enjoy, though, King Shark, you know, the character is Sylvester Stallone. I mean, there's a little bit of a, that's funny to me. That's a nice bit of wit. That's why I said I thought the screenplay had its moments where, you know, there were some moments of brilliance if it was meant to be the sort of a dark story. But I just don't think it delivers in the end. I don't think this is a very successful movie. It wasn't even fun to watch, even with Idris Elba in it. And, you know, you really have to work hard at ruining an Idris Elba movie. Better movie, for those of you who will just watch, like me, watch anything with him in it, is the recent Concrete Cowboys. And I want to add that John Cena described his character as Peacemaker as a douchebag Captain America. And doesn't that just kind of say it all? I mean, I get the idea of it, but why would you want to see that? Why? Who wants to go out to see douchebag Captain America, Mike? Who is this audience?
Well, it's not me, though. I am the one actually watching it. An indication that people may be actually turned off a bit is this is a film with a huge budget, $185 million. It was released simultaneously theatrical and HBO Max. And although it opened big in theaters, it fell off very quickly. So maybe either people are watching at home or they're just not watching. So I think that supports the point you're making. What ultimately I found kind of depressing about it is that you have some really gifted actors like Idris Elba and Viola Davis. But in this film, all she does, she plays this administrator with a really, you know, harsh personality. That's all there is for her in the script. She stands in the control room, if you will, and shouts at people over the phone. And there's nothing else to the character, really. And where I find it depressing is these are some gifted actors. And yeah, it's a big paycheck and public recognition, you know, for a big summer blockbuster. But you know what? Think of the movies they could be making instead of this.
You're right, Mike. They all deserve better than what went on in this movie. But that brings us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you there.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.